When I think of associations, I think that they're frequently looking for new ways to generate new revenue, to engage their members, but they jump to answers and they jump to solutions and they look at pricing before they take the earlier steps that would enable them to have more data and to have more confidence and just being able to experiment in new ways.
Hi, I'm Christine Shaw, CEO and President of Naylor Association Solutions, and I'm your host of the Association Advisor Podcast. We'll learn from successful association executives, partners, and clients on how to grow membership engagement and non-dues revenue to create a thriving, prosperous, and value-driven association. I invite you to join me in keeping informed and, most importantly, keeping your association profitable. Our goal is to leave you feeling inspired, more confident, and more knowledgeable. This is the Association Advisor Podcast.
Welcome to the Association Advisor Podcast, brought to you by Naylor Association Solutions. I'm your host, Christine Shaw. What if the biggest barrier to growing your association's revenue isn't the pricing or offerings, but how your association thinks about risk? Our guest today, Sherry Jacobs, has spent her career helping associations look at that very question. She's the CEO of Avenue M Group, a global research and consulting firm that helps associations increase membership, drive revenue, and strengthen their brands. She's also a best-selling author whose work focuses on navigating uncertainty and building more adaptable teams. Her latest book is The Unexpected Power of Boundaries: Rethinking the Rules, Risks, and Real Drivers of Innovation. In today's conversation, we'll explore how associations can rethink risk, experiment with new pricing models, and create the kind of structure that fuels innovation and revenue growth. So let's get into it. Sherry, welcome to this episode of the Association Advisor Podcast. I am so excited to have you as a guest here with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
Awesome. Well, you know, where I'd like to begin is to let our listeners learn a little bit more about you. You've spent your career helping associations navigate change and think about growth differently. Tell us a little bit about your career journey and what attracted you to work with associations to begin with.
Yeah, absolutely. I started working at an association early in my career. It was a small global organization. And then I worked for one of the largest associations in the world, and then for a regional one. And from that experience, I discovered early on that many times associations just pushed information out there. And that one-way street was just okay. It worked for so many years. They were the authoritative source. They sent information to people, and people were appreciated to have it and to join. But over time, what I discovered is that they needed to have more of a two-way street and to have members and individuals contribute in a different way. And as I started to observe this, I left associations and started my own company about in 2009, so almost 17 years ago.
Wow.
Because I wanted to create that two-way street, which is why I call it Avenue M Group. It creates a two-way street between associations and their members. And we do that through research and strategy.
That was a fantastic background story around how the name of your company evolved. I'm always fascinated to know like where brand names come from, and that is absolutely brilliant. And you're one of the outliers, dare I say, because most people happen into associations and you started early on in your career, which really gives you a lot of perspective and knowledge. So I can't wait to share with our listeners more about your skills in this very important space. But let's talk about revenue. Okay, top of mind, we know, is how do they increase revenue, particularly with memberships at risk and some of them declining. Often associations tend to focus on pricing, but you believe that rethinking risk is the way to go. Explain that concept.
Sure. So I think of pricing as a downstream decision. So what I mean by that is we jump to pricing, which is a how. How are we going to solve the problem before we clearly articulate the why? Why are we doing this? And what? What are the things that we need to consider? And so as organizations make decisions because they've jumped to the how, let's change the price. They start assessing their, you know, can we do this and how that will impact us rather than thinking of the bigger picture. And then the way that risk comes into this is it becomes an emotional decision because they've jumped to that how rather than a capacity decision. Can we do this and how does that impact the outcome of it? So they jump to, should we raise dues? Should we add a new pricing tier? Should we think of pricing in a different way? They're jumping to solutions before they've considered the various risks that are associated and where they have the capacity to make change.
No, and that makes absolute sense. I mean, we see it over and over again. Salespeople are trained to think about what's your budget, which is the last question you should be asking. But help us draw that back to revenue growth and how to tie that into the difference maker for associations when it comes to growing revenue specifically.
Sure. One of the easiest ways that I can do this is actually to tell a story. It's not from the association world, but that's my favorite thing to do is to look for these examples outside the association world and then connect the dots back to the associations. So I do talk about separating the why, the what, the how. The why is not just your mission, but it's why are we moving into this new space? You know, the why is the why this matters. And so a great example, highly regulated industry, banking, and it was Bank of America. And Bank of America's why was we want to help people save more money. That's a really good business decision for the bank, and it's a really good decision for the customers. So that's a why. The how, they hadn't decided what they were going to do. But the what was where they came in and they said, here are things that we cannot change or we will not change about our organization. And that's critical. So they said, first of all, we're not going to invest in a new platform, a new technology, a new app. They created that as part of the boundaries. That's the what. I love this part. They also said, we're not going to change people's spending habits. So we're going to meet them where they are. And so if you think of associations in this analogy, we're trying to increase revenue through our education or bring on a new category of membership and have them engage with us. But they often want people to change how they do things. We want them to come to our in-person meeting or we want them to adapt to something. Bank of America said, we are going to work within those constraints. And then finally, they said, we got to make this easy and frictionless. So using those constraints, their team came up with a program called Keep the Change. And every time
I remember that brand, that whole campaign they did.
The whole campaign.
Yeah.
So every time a customer used a debit card to purchase their Starbucks or whatever they were making a purchase on, Bank of America would round up to the nearest dollar and transfer the money from their checking to a savings account. And so it had no new technology. The existing debit card didn't change behavior and was frictionless. And they were able to launch this program and actually minimize their risk involved in creating and investing in a whole new program, not knowing if it would work, but because they defined the what, you know, they defined the why and the how, they just left out there to explore. When I think of associations, I think that they're frequently looking for new ways to generate new revenue, to engage their members, but they jump to answers and they jump to solutions and they look at pricing before they take the earlier steps that would enable them to have more data and have more confidence in and just being able to experiment in new ways.
I love that. And, you know, I think oftentimes it's a term that's well known called being a focus group of one. We're so focused internally on what we think we want and need rather than getting external and making it about the customers or the members, et cetera. So when you can use examples like you just did at Bank of America, I think that really helps. I want to go back to the area around risks because you make a very big distinction between risk tolerance and capacity. And you also have a tool, a risk capacity quiz. Walk us through what all that means and what that looks like.
Sure. If you have worked in an association, you have probably heard the phrase risk tolerance or said it yourself. You said, my board has very low risk tolerance. Or even recently, I was talking to an association executive who said, we have really high risk tolerance. And that's exciting when that happens, or it's exciting when you think about, okay, people are willing to take risks. But that's the wrong question. It isn't about having low or high risk tolerance. That will always exist. And that isn't something that I think that people should try to change. Instead, they should focus on their risk capacity. And that might be how diverse are their current revenue streams? How strong is their brand reputation? How deep is their market penetration? Other factors that we ask in this quiz to say, okay, before we make decisions around change or experiment with new ideas, let's assess this. And if you may have low, medium, or high risk capacity, we're not saying you need to have high risk capacity. We're saying you need to know what is your capacity for making risk, for making changes, so that you can make decisions based on that, not based on gut or emotions or how you feel about that what's going to happen if it doesn't work. Your question should be, if this fails, would we be okay? And would we learn something and help us advance? It shouldn't be around, how do I feel about risk?
I love this so much because you just framed it in a way, to your point, that takes the emotion and the opinion out of it. And having a tool to do that, I was just on ASAE's Future Foresight webinar where we were with a lot of directors and CEOs of associations, and they talked about right now, trust, especially at the board, it's eroding from the standpoint of we're all humans and we're in such a divisive environment and we have AI on the scene. And this kind of is the levelizer. If you take a tool like you've developed, a risk capacity, I almost feel like it should be required at every board. Like, you know, remove the emotional debate and put it in like a risk assessment quiz or tool. I think that could really help association leaders make the right decisions. So well done. How can people get that tool, by the way, if they're interested in doing that?
Yeah, if they want to reach out to me directly at Avenue M Group, I can help them with that. People ask us all the time, like, how many people can take it? Can it be our staff and our board? And the answer is yes. And there is no limit to the number of people, but it is really interesting to look at it. The one last thing I'll add is that so many people who also work on the staff aren't necessarily looking at putting their entire job at risk. And so it's not just volunteer leaders. There are many departments. It can be in the finance department, the legal department, that their job is to consider risk, but also to maybe be even personally less tolerant of making change happen. They love it when you've assessed your capacity because now you're making decisions based on data and you're not taking wild risks or wild investments over one decision of a leader who comes in and says, here's my pet project, let's try this. So it's actually really good for both staff and for leaders.
I love that. So my motto is data-driven decisions should always be at the heart of what we do. So that's fantastic. Thank you for sharing that. I really appreciate it. One other question before we move off that, though, is do you ever see people are surprised at the outcome of the results or what they're looking at when they take their capacity quiz? Like, what do you see? What do you find?
So the surprises come in when the leaders have taken the quiz and leaders answer the questions candidly. You know, we don't share the individual responses. What they find is that their leadership has more risk capacity than they or the leaders realize. So it's not saying that they're high risk capacity. Like an example, Amazon could be high risk capacity, right? Deep, deep pockets, they could take lots of risks. I often say my local pizza place that's right around the corner from my house, low risk capacity. They have a defined market. They have a smaller budget. Their capacity for changes is much smaller than Amazon. But what they find, what the leaders find is that it is higher than what they expected it to be. And that is usually the surprise that comes up.
I would have thought the opposite. So that's really interesting to hear you say that. Let's say you're an association leader, you've gone online, you reached out to you, you've taken the quiz. Then what are steps they do? Like maybe they want to improve their capacity at risk, or maybe they're okay with it. What's next after you do it?
One of the things that I talk about is a couple different areas where you can pilot and you can explore and test. Now, first is where do we get the ideas for testing new ideas? How can we, again, minimize use data? How can we minimize our risk? And one of the areas that is most often overlooked is your frontline staff. The individuals, and then this is true for associations, but for companies, for healthcare organizations, the people that are closest to the customer, the client, the patient, whomever it might be, they often know both what the problems are, but also what are potential solutions to test. And so the first step is to really make sure that all these decisions around new things to test and taking more shots, as I call it, don't just come from the corner office, from the C-suite, from the senior management team and the leaders, but making sure that the people who are closest to it, that are hearing about it, have a voice in this. So that's step one, making sure you gather.
Yeah. It reminds me of a story I read today about the CEO. I think it's Ed Bastian. If I got the first name wrong, I apologize. He's the CEO of Delta. He was hired to bring the company out of bankruptcy 10 years ago in 2009-ish. And it's currently now the number one most profitable airline. But what he said is he focused exactly that on his employees, because he said if he obsessed on the employees, they're the ones closest to the customer. And the customers with Delta now, when he first took over, the number one criteria was price when choosing Delta. It's completely reversed, and it's about the brand and the experience. And most Delta people absolutely obsess about Delta and say that, you know, they're loyal to the brand versus anything else. So it's interesting, that analogy and the correlation, like obsess with your employees who are closest to the customer, because they'll help you, you know. So now let's talk about new pricing models, which is what you work on a lot, in revenue streams. So let's say an association does the tool, they understand their capacity. What are some ideas, or how should they go about experimenting? I love when you say pilot, we have a model, pilot and prove it at Naylor. So how can they experiment with new pricing models or revenue streams and guardrails?
So one is you can set your own boundaries. So constraints and boundaries are different. Constraints are things put upon you, right? Those are time, resources, financial. Oftentimes, those are not things that you can change. But you can set boundaries that allow you and your team to test. And it could be, we're going to test this with 5% of our audience. Now, the pushback that I hear is, what if the word gets out? What if some members hear about it? Great. You know, bring them in. That is part of experimentation and testing. Share with them that this isn't a decision that we've made. We're exploring this as a new opportunity. And if you want to be a part of it, fantastic. But think about, and I don't see this often, but I'm starting to see it more often, which is organizations being comfortable with piloting and testing to a small percentage of their audience. That is one guardrail that associations can do when they are starting to experiment and think about things. Another thing they can do is put in time guardrails. So we are going to do this, and you know, and over the next 90 days, we are going to make a decision. And then the last one is define what success looks like and be firm on the decisions you're going to make if you reach it or you don't. So I'm going to give you a really quick story about this, again, from outside associations, but it's another story I love and I was a part of, actually. So many years ago, I left my association work to go work at a .com that actually made it. And when we were starting, this was a time when no financial transactions were being conducted online. People were using the internet for emails and checking up sports scores or going into chat rooms. And so we had this idea that the internet could save people time, money, and give them more control in a space that we launched this company. And so the company was called Sure Payroll, and it was offering payroll services. So we had an opportunity. We were trying to sell through direct sales. And we had an opportunity to partner with Citibank, who, big name, credibility, and even better, they were going to put the special offer in bank statements, co-branded, right, with a special offer in there, to 300,000 small business owners. Now, back at this day, nobody had online banking. So right, their bank statement, we had 100% open rate. We had 100% that we got it to the right person because it was the owner of the small business that was opening it. It was the perfect test. Yeah. It went out, 300,000 people. We set up phone lines. We got 3 calls and 1 customer.
And oh my goodness.
It was shocked, right? So what we did was we pulled the plug. And we said, we're going to end all direct mail and we're going to shift to direct sales. And then we created boundaries for our sales team, but allowed them to customize the script. And we also created boundaries around who were the ideal customer. Mm-hmm. And in 6 months, we grew to be the largest online payroll company in the world and eventually acquired by Paychex.
That's amazing.
I share that because it is such a great story about when you are going to experiment, be very clear around what success looks like. And if it doesn't work in your experiment, pull the plug. Say, we're not going to keep testing this. Say, we've learned from this. Let's move on.
And there's so much I love about what you just said. And there's three key things. Number one, when you start out with saying, if a few people that are your customers find out, bring them in. Often we want to make it so secretive. And to your point, like, what if something's not going to work? Do you want to wait until you've spent a lot of time and money on something? So if customers are in the fold, fantastic, as long as the exposure is limited and you have a trust relationship. The other thing by sharing that story, so I, like you, started at a dot-com company back in the late 90s. We were at Tech Online. It's one of the few that made it as well. It was online virtual lab for design engineers, which is so fun. So I knew I really loved that. And the guardrails or the metrics, because people get too emotional. And if something doesn't work, they want to double down instead of going, you know what? It's not working. Let's pull back and pivot. Like, we're so afraid to do that. And you have to not let that be the driver of, you know, success, because it could end up being a failure. And unless you can recognize it and pull it back. And the safetiness for employees to say, it's okay. Not everything you try is going to succeed, but that's okay, because you're going to learn and you're going to learn what's going to work about your customers. So that was fantastic. So Sherry, I had the pleasure of seeing you speak at ASAE's The Exchange, the Women's Experience last year, where you shared your photography. And a lot of people don't know that you're a very accomplished wildlife photographer. So I'm curious to know how you became a wildlife photographer to begin with. And then what lessons have you learned from that that carry over in your work with associations today?
Oh, thank you for asking. My favorite topic, probably. So when I got out of college for a very short time frame before I worked at my first association, I was a photojournalist. I worked at newspapers around the country, including taking photos of Michael Jordan when he played for the Bulls in the conference championship games. And it was a passion of mine. And after a few years working in newspapers, I started a nonprofit to teach photography to girls in Chicago. And I transitioned into nonprofit work, my first association job. I put down my cameras and I really didn't think about it. I love the association community very much. But about 7 years ago, I picked up a camera again. And what is very similar to sports is wildlife photography. You can't set it up. You have to create something from something that happens in front of you. Everything about it, I loved. So I started photographing locally, hummingbirds, and then moved on to globally and have taken many trips to Africa. I've also been to the Arctic and to Antarctica. And one of the lessons, I have had failures, absolute failures, and I've had tremendous success. And as we all do, we often learn more from our failures, and that helps us. And I went all the way up to the Arctic. We were the northernmost boat in the world. It was minus 40 degrees. And for your listeners who prefer Celsius, it's also minus 40. And I am there trying to photograph the polar bear, and I'm overwhelmed in indecision. I had brought every camera I owned, every lens, and I could stand anywhere, and I missed the shot completely. And as gut-wrenching as it was, that actually led me down the path to think about, why did that happen? And I went down a research rabbit hole, which is very on brand for me. And as I started exploring this is how I wrote my book, The Unexpected Power of Boundaries. But it doesn't end there. I did go to Antarctica. And when I was in Antarctica, and I was again in that situation where there was an incredible sight in front of us, there were whales, dozens of whales, and they were creating a bubbling effect, bringing fish to the surface. And I'm in my boat, but there are 30 other photographers, and we're all shooting the same thing. I paused this time, and I created boundaries. I said, I'm not going to take a photo where there are other people in the shot. I'm not going to take a photo where there is chaos going on. And I'm not going to shoot something that everyone else is doing. Where can I look in the unexpected places? And that's when I captured this amazing shot of this one whale out in the distance with its tail dripping water. And that shot has stayed with me because I put in those boundaries and I thought about, what can I do with what I have in this situation? So I do bring in the stories from the photography into my book and into the work I do too.
I love it. And like I said, I was fortunate enough to get to hear that story and see the beautiful image you captured. And I mean, just seeing that, that stayed with me. It's the first thing I remember about you when we were talking about having you on the podcast. So I love that you can weave that. You have such a fascinating and diverse background. It's amazing. It's no wonder people love hearing from you and working with you. It's just your work and knowledge speak volumes. So it's exciting. So Sherry, we always close out by asking our guests to share a resource that can help them. It could be a podcast, a book, or I would love, since you're such a wealth of knowledge, for you to share something with our listeners to help them keep learning.
Oh, thank you so much. So yes, I am going to recommend the book that I just wrote, The Unexpected Power of Boundaries, Rethinking the Rules, Risks, and Real Drivers of Innovation. There are so many fun stories, relatable stories, but even better, I have a lot of tools in there, including the risk capacity quiz. So you could even just buy the simple book and run the quiz yourself within your own organization, and it's a great resource. And you can find that book everywhere that books are sold, on Amazon. It did just hit the number one bestseller list for business and innovation.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, congratulations, Sherry. So well done. I'm happy for you.
Thank you. I really provide a lot more than just stories, but also tools and resources in the book.
I love that. I am going to get it myself. So what's the best way listeners can connect with you or reach out to you?
Yeah, they can reach out to me either at Avenue M Group or at sherryjacobs.com if they're interested in working with me in Avenue M or hiring me to be a keynote speaker and share these ideas with their audiences.
I love it. Well, this was a fantastic episode. Thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it. And I know our listeners are going to learn a lot from your experience.
Thank you so much for having me. It was truly a pleasure.
As season 4 of the Association Advisor podcast comes to an end, we want to thank you for listening. We hope these conversations have given you new ideas, fresh perspectives, and practical ways to think about growth and revenue in your association. For more insights, strategies, and resources, be sure to subscribe to the Association Advisor newsletter at the link in the show notes or visit associationadvisor.com. And if you've enjoyed this season, stay in the know by following us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next season.